Yesterday it was pagers, today walkie-talkies.
So people are very afraid because we don't know what else has been meddled with.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, how people in Lebanon are feeling after two attacks detonated electronic devices across the country.
And in Sudan, over 750,000 people are experiencing catastrophic hunger. In other words, famine.
They're eating leaves off trees, eating grass.
Also in India, 10 days of celebration end with families sending statues of the god Ganesha into the water. Just one problem with that.
You are changing the local ecosystem.
How new rules for the ritual played out this year in Mumbai.
Plus, it turns out soil makes noise.
It's pretty alien sounding.
All that and more today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Yesterday, a coordinated attack in Lebanon targeted pagers carried by suspected members of Hezbollah. The pagers exploded, leaving 12 people dead and nearly 3,000 injured.
Today, another attack, this time walkie-talkies detonated. So far, we're hearing reports of 14 people killed and hundreds wounded. Israel is presumed to have staged both attacks. Defense Minister Yoav Gallant spoke about the excellent achievements by Israel's spy agency and military, but Israel has not officially taken responsibility. Hezbollah holds Israel fully responsible. And across Lebanon, there is tension and fear. Nizar Ghanem is in Beirut, where he's the research director at the Alternative Policy Institute. I asked him where he was during yesterday's attack.
Honestly, we were at the funeral of Elias Khoury, a prominent novelist who just died. We were in the church, and then I finished the funeral, and I was going out of the church, and I heard people screaming or running. And then I just saw the social media and understood the scale of it. It quite reminded me of, like, of 4 of August, the explosion of the port. The scale of terror, you know, the just seeing civilians running towards the hospitals, the general, you know, anxiety and fear in the city. It's a dystopic event. It's an Orwellian, you know, kind of an episode of Black Mirror coming to reality. It's quite unnerving.
You're talking about the port explosion in 2020 in Beirut. And then again today, more attacks. What do we know about this second round of explosions?
So today it's the walkie-talkies, which means that it seems that the batteries are exploding with some kind of a transmission that kind of activates the explosion. So people are very afraid because we don't know what else has been meddled with. Is it cell phones as well? We have no idea about the scale of the penetration. But this is definitely a massive terror attack. Because it's, you know, I mean, it's attacking everybody, including, like, the walkie-talkies are used by Red Cross in Lebanon, for example. Even the pagers are used by hospital personnel. There's even been accusations against the American University of Beirut because they changed their pagers like 15 days ago. There's a lot of, you know, misinformation and terror going in the streets.
With that kind of lack of knowledge and being in the dark about what's going on, what kinds of things are people in Lebanon feeling and expressing today? Like, what's the general mood, especially with more detonations today?
People are terrified because it's very unknown what's going to happen. But I think at the same time, it raises a lot of questions. A lot of people are talking about, okay, so are there even rules of engagement with Israel? Is there anything called international law or rules of war? I mean, is it now a free game to kind of like load cell phones with explosives and detonate them among a civilian population? So I think there is a lot of rage. There's a lot of fear as well. And I would say there's a bit of blaming as well, because, you know, at the same time, Lebanon is hijacked by Hezbollah in terms of its war and peace decisions. You know, it took a decision to single-handedly go on a war in Israel. So politically, the country is divided.
This public sense in Lebanon that this was a terror attack, is that prompting people to change their behavior in any way today?
You know, my dad called me when he heard about the attack, and he was afraid of my cell phone. And I told him, I bought my cell phone in America, so don't worry. It's not made for Arabs. I think there's a general feel after Gaza itself that there are double standards. That what goes for the region, for if you're Middle Eastern or an Arab, you know, you're outside the realm of international law. Anything goes. There are no rules. There's no Geneva Convention, it seems. And this is, I think, what the people feel. They feel abandoned.
Along with the fear that you're describing among Lebanese, is there also anger? And who is it directed at?
There's definitely a lot of anger towards Israelis, for sure. There's a lot of anger towards Hezbollah as well. Many people consider that, you know, Hezbollah didn't take the right precautions. So there's also a lot of anger towards the security apparatus, Lebanese security apparatus. People were saying, okay, where are these cybersecurity bureau in Lebanon that only attacks freedom of expression if an activist posts something on Facebook, but they're not there to actually secure the basics of infrastructure. So I think it's triple. It's against the government, against Hezbollah, and against the Israelis, for sure. And I would say, I mean, with what is going on in Gaza, definitely the international community, which somehow has abandoned the Middle East for, you know, oblivion.
Nizar, can you just elaborate a little bit more about popular sentiment toward Hezbollah going into these attacks? And do you think the shock of these attacks could bring some public sympathy for Hezbollah?
You know, Hezbollah lost a lot of public sympathy because of the civil war in Syria and the suppression of the revolution against Assad. I would say that this current wave of conflict with Israel has gained them a lot of popularity because a lot of people look at what's happening in Gaza as unacceptable, and they find the position of Hezbollah as kind of moderate because they're saying we don't want a full-scale war, but we want an end of the atrocities in Gaza. So actually, Hezbollah, I would say in this war, won a lot in Lebanon, at least, and in the region. Popular sentiment is definitely with Hezbollah. There is an added sympathy. However, there are sections that that kind of consider Hezbollah deserved it, given what happened in Syria earlier. But overall, I would say the mass majority are sympathetic with the civilian casualties.
So can you give us a little more context for these attacks in a country that's been going through a lot economically in the past 3 years?
Lebanon is witnessing a hyperinflationary scenario. More than 80% are under poverty line. It's financial collapse by all means. We don't even have proper electricity or water. You know, I mean, it's a country, a failed state, you would say. The tourist season for sure has been wiped out, which means that areas that were not affected before by the war in the south are now affected economically, and they feel it. There's no car to be seen. Everybody's expecting either a massive war or something big to happen.
You referred a moment ago to Lebanon as a failed state, Nizar. Is that how Lebanese people widely feel about their government and about Hezbollah being de facto in control?
You know, we're like the Caucasus, like Georgia or Armenia, or, you know, we're small states among big elephants. And when the big elephants move, you would like to hide under a bed or something, you know. And this is how the Lebanese feel right now, that there are bigger things happening in the region. The Americans, the Iranians, the Russians. So the feeling is that we have no clear idea where the ship is going. So I would say Lebanon is a critical juncture. But again, it has always been on a critical juncture for the past 80 years. So the Lebanese also know how to sip their wine at the end of the day and have fun with everything happening.
Nizar Ghanem is the research director at the Alternative Policy Institute. He joined us from Beirut.
Floods in Asia, Africa, and Europe have been grabbing our attention this week. Destructive floods in Central and Eastern Europe have a counterpoint on the other side of the continent. Fire. More than 100 wildfires fueled by hot, dry conditions in Portugal have stretched firefighters to their limits. 7 people have reportedly been killed there since the blazes started over the weekend. Prime Minister Luis Montenegro has declared a state of calamity for the hardest hit areas. The European Union called the current walloping by both floods and fires proof of a climate breakdown. EU Crisis Management Commissioner Yanis Lenarčič said today this tragedy is not an anomaly. This is fast becoming the norm.
In the Indian city of Mumbai, millions of Hindus are just now wrapping up the annual 10-day celebration of Ganpati, a holiday dedicated to Lord Ganesha, the elephant god, head of an elephant, body of a man. People bring statues of the god to their homes to offer up prayers before releasing them into the water, rivers, lakes, and the Arabian Sea.
Part of the ritual takes an environmental toll. So this year, a state high court issued a ban on using certain materials in those statues just as the festivities were set to begin. Namratha Kolachalam reports from Mumbai.
10 days ago, I joined thousands of people waiting in line at a large gathering hall for a first look at Mumbai's most famous idol of Lord Ganesha, the god of wisdom and luck.
Lalbagh ke raja jo hai, Bombay ke.
People from all over the world come here, says worshipper Sunil Singh. Whatever you pray for, you definitely get. Singh took a 12-hour train ride from a neighboring state, walked from his hotel barefoot and waited in line for 4 hours in the sweltering heat. After taking in the 15-foot-tall statue that's draped in sparkling jewelry, he feels it's all worth it. I feel very blessed, he says. I feel like I've gotten everything I wanted from the Lord. On the first day of the holiday, everyone's excited to welcome Lord Ganesha. There's music and dancing in the streets. People purchase statues of Ganesha from local vendors. Some are small and worshipped at home. Others are much larger and celebrated in local communities. All of them are eventually released into lakes, rivers, and the Arabian Sea. But this year, many of these idols are technically banned by the state high court. Dr. Shyam Askalekar, an expert in environmental engineering, says the reason is most of them are made from a type of plaster called plaster of Paris, which carries pollutants.
So you put at place A, it will go to place B. You think that you have put in one place, but you have no idea how much long distance can it travel on its own.
From a stream to a river to the depths of the ocean.
The moment you put too many idols, hundreds of thousands of idols you are putting in the water body at various places, you are changing the local ecosystem.
The High Court order came as welcome relief to environmentalists, but also to sculptors who make the idols out of clay. One of them is Santosh Shaharkar, who says he's in stiff competition with Plaster of Paris sculptors. A large section of customers, he says, are more focused on the price, so they prefer Plaster of Paris. The idols he makes are biodegradable, but tend to cost more. 4 years ago, he followed guidelines from a central government agency and switched to making clay statues, but many idol makers did not. And that doesn't feel fair. When manufacturing Plaster of Paris idols, he says, one sculptor can produce around 20 idols per day. With clay, that sculptor can only make 3 or 4. This disadvantage led him to become a petitioner before the state high court. And in August, the court ruled in his favor, confirming that Plaster of Paris was banned and calling for the law to be enforced. But just a week after the ruling, I visit Juhu Beach, where a number of families are singing and praying to their Plaster of Paris idols. One woman, Rajna, says they considered switching to a biodegradable statue of Bappa Murthy, another term for Ganesha, but they changed their minds.
We are just doing one thing for a very long time. You can't convince your family, especially, because eco-friendly Bappa Murthys are quite smaller in size.
She says it's a bad omen to bring an idol home that's smaller than the one you had the year before. Clay idols tend to be smaller, heavier, and more prone to cracking than the ones made of plaster. For the huge public idols that draw worshippers to Mumbai from all around the country, Plaster of Paris is really preferred.
Jai Bhavani! Jai Shivaji!
Jai Bhavani!
Jai Shivaji!
On the final day of the festival, massive crowds gather at Girgaon Chowpatty, a beach near the heart of the city, for the grand finale. Hundreds of 20 to 30-foot Ganesha idols tower overhead on the street. Loudspeakers guide thousands of worshippers in chants. And slowly, all of these enormous Plaster of Paris Ganesha idols are rolled to the beach, where they're finally released into the Arabian Sea. Some organizers, like a man who goes by the name Venki, says they'll try to make their idols from clay next year, but it won't be easy. If we make it with clay, it's very heavy and unstable, and the jewelry will leave lines on the idol, he says. But others are ready for the Ganpati holiday to return to its bio-friendly roots. Risha Ahuja, another worshipper, says that historically, the Ganpati sculptures were made from sand and clay. She says the size of the idols doesn't matter.
Even we are having a smallest Ganpati in our home, we treat them like it's an actual Ganpati.
The most important part, she says, is believing. For The World, I'm Namrata Kalachalam in Mumbai.
You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. It's been almost 5 years since Evo Morales was president of Bolivia, but his shadow looms large over politics there. Yesterday, several thousand Morales supporters clashed violently with supporters of the current president, Luis Arce. The two men were once political allies, but are now in a bitter power struggle. Morales plans to run for president again. Catherine Lederber is the director of the Andean Information Network and spoke to us from Cochabamba, Bolivia.
It's a complicated situation. There's a lot of intense political polarization. I do want to point out that, you know, it was a peaceful march. There was clear evidence that on the intervening side, there were police officers, tear gas used by the Arce government. This really points to, you know, an extreme internal division within the MAS party, but also an Arce administration that's kind of backed into a corner. They've been kind of staying in power by hanging on by their fingernails, because not only is the political division hurting them, they also have an empty treasury, they have gasoline shortages. U.S. dollar has basically disappeared from Bolivia, and that was the mainstay of many people's lives. So it's a complex conflict that's internal, but it also is reflecting shortages, inflation, and an overall lack of contentment with Arce's performance up to now.
The MAS party is Arce's party, correct? The one in power. What does it stand for?
MAS is, of course, the party of both Arce and Evo Morales. The initials stand for the Movement Towards Socialism Party. It's the largest party in the country. Morales ruled this party and ruled Bolivia for 3 terms before he was violently ousted before the end of his 3rd term by a right-wing coalition supported by the military. It was a representative party of grassroots organizations of indigenous people, of workers' unions, of agrarian workers, and it was meant to be encompassing of traditionally displaced sectors in Bolivia. Now, with this division and criticisms on both sides, you can see a grassroots upswell in protest of Arce as they perceive that this government has moved away from its grassroots foundation and its connection to the grassroots. Although you see social movements divided between support for Morales and support for Arce.
So as you mentioned, of course, the current president Arce and the former president Morales are both from the same party. Can you tell me more about what happened to create these divisions that see the party split in two?
Arce was the finance minister under Evo Morales, and it was a period of time where they were able to use abundant income through a shift in gas reserves in order to really fuel social programs and to improve the lives of low-income Bolivians. After the crisis, after the pandemic, Bolivia was in a much different situation. And you have seen protests and disagreements over the actions of key ministers, something that in the past grassroots groups had been able to ask for them to be changed, and it had happened. Whereas Arce made choices to have a group of close personal contacts as ministers that for the most part he's been unwilling to change. There was an attempted coup or a general who claimed to be trying to oust Arce in June, which was something very, very odd. But we have to also worry about the security forces. Are they firmly under the control of the civilian government? Can they be bought off again? I mean, there's a great potential for this conflict to explode and to become quite messy.
One of the exacerbating factors here is that Evo Morales wants to run for president again in 2025, but the current president says that's not possible. What's that issue there?
Evo Morales very controversially ran for a 4th term, and that is when the coup took place. But according to the Bolivian constitution right now, he has the right to run for a non-consecutive term. This is something that Arce denies. This is something that Arce has attempted to get the constitutional tribunal to rule on. Arce, along with other political forces, agreed to cancel, for example, the primaries. It's a political reality that in spite of the polarization, I think Morales is probably the politician that has the greatest amount of popular support.
Catherine Lederber of the Andean Information Network. She spoke to us from Cochabamba, Bolivia.
We can tell a lot about what's going on in nature based on what we see. A yellow daffodil means it's spring. Bear tracks in the dirt mean, yeah, you're in their habitat, take a different path. But how the environment sounds can provide just as much information, sometimes in places where we simply expect silence. The World's Bianca Hillier brings us new research on the sound of soil.
Standing out in my garden, I can hear a lot of things going on. Birds are chirping, bees are buzzing. What I can't hear with my naked ear, though, is the sound of the soil. But if I stuck my microphone into the dirt, it might sound something like this.
We're calling them cracks and pops and stuff, and it's pretty alien sounding.
Alex Taylor studies ecology at Flinders University in Adelaide, Australia. His team recently published new research that uses super-sensitive microphones to listen to and analyze different kinds of soil. When they listened to healthy and biodiverse soil,
you see this rise in diversity of sound, the complexity of sound. You can imagine a worm wriggling its way through soil. Water is moving through it and air is moving through it. The millipedes and the ants, every time their legs sort of tap and tap and tap, they're moving soil around and it's all creating vibrations and sound.
Taylor's team also listened to unhealthy soil, which can be a result of deforestation, mass urbanization, overgrazing, and other destructive practices. That soil sounded very different. Unhealthy soil is nearly silent because there aren't as many critters in there moving around.
Silence in a soil soundscape would be pretty sad.
And yet, that's what the majority of soil could sound like. A recent UN report says 75% of the Earth's soils are degraded. That number is expected to rise to 90% by 2050 if current trends continue. Taylor says being able to determine soil's health by listening to it replaces traditional methods, which are expensive, disruptive, and laborious, requiring scientists to manually sift through the soil.
Results strongly support, for sure, that it's just as effective as the traditional methods.
The new findings add to a field of research called ecoacoustics, which is the study of sounds produced by animals, plants, and their environment. Ecoacoustics has been used to study animals like bats, birds, and frogs, but using it to determine the health of soil is new. Taylor says the findings could help inform policy on environmental management.
As a hypothetical, you've got a local council that is wondering where they need to put their efforts, and a park ranger can go out and use ecoacoustics and say, hey, look, this super critical river bank has super unhealthy soils. We're going to need some funding. That's kind of the end goal.
Taylor and his team conducted their ecoacoustics research in Australia's grassy woodlands and the UK's temperate forests. More research will need to be done to see how the technique would work in other ecosystems and whether it would be as effective. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
You're listening to The World.
People in Japan say they're having a hard time finding rice at the grocery store. Some are blaming the weather, others tourists. Japanese rice farmers in full harvest mode wonder what's going on.
Is there really a rice shortage? Really? She asks.
That story and more news from around the globe still coming up here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. For the whole continent of South America, it is a crown jewel, the Itaipu Hydroelectric Dam. It has the largest energy output of any dam on Earth, run jointly by two countries, Paraguay and Brazil. The international cooperation is a source of pride and also tension. Michael Fox takes us to the dam on the Paraná River for the story.
The Itaipu Hydroelectric Dam in southern Brazil is massive, a huge cement snake stretching across the Paraná River, the world's 10th largest waterway.
In order to build up the dam, they used more than 12 million cubic meters in concrete. That will be enough to build up more than 200 soccer stadiums as big as Maracanã Stadium in Rio de Janeiro.
That's the voice of one of the guides on a tour I took of the complex a couple of weeks ago. Denise Flauzino was also along for the ride. She's retired, visiting from Rio de Janeiro. It's her second time here. I think it should be among the seven wonders of the world, she says. I think it's wonderful, really pretty, and sensational engineering, she says. You get a sense of this when you walk inside an area they call the cathedral. The concrete ceiling rises above you, sloping off in a triangle shape, which is meant to decrease the pressure of the water from the lake on the structure. Itaipu worker Tayana Morales takes us on an elevator down into the complex. She says we can't stay here for more than a few minutes because of the sound of the generators, which can reach nearly 100 decibels. It is overwhelming. Before me, a metal shaft is spinning round and round, pushed by the water beneath us that's gushing through the dam. This is it, the heart of Itaipu's energy production, or rather, one of the 20 hearts or turbines that stretch out in a roughly mile-long row across the dam. This one plant provides electricity to 80 million people in Brazil and Paraguay. Morales says it has the capacity to produce 14,000 megawatts of power. That's seven times the size of the iconic Hoover Dam between Arizona and Nevada. But Itaipu has come at a cost. In order to build the dam, they had to flood more than 500 square miles of land, inundating natural wonders and forcing out indigenous communities. There was resistance at the time, but the dam was pushed through in part because it was developed and built during the 1970s and 80s, while both Brazil and Paraguay were led by military dictatorships. Today, from the top of the complex, Lake Itaipu is immense. You can't even see the far side, but those involved say it has been worth it.
Eu analiso como se fosse filho.
Itaipu is like my child, says Lasso Cardoso, who helped to build the dam and worked at the complex for 12 years. I saw it being born and growing up. Now she is making art, the most beautiful art, which is the generation of energy, clean and renewable energy. There's something else particularly interesting about Itaipu. It's a joint venture constructed and operated by both Brazil and Paraguay.
Itaipu era uma nova política.
Local foreign relations history professor Mikael Alvino da Silva says back when it was being built, the Brazilians said Itaipu represented a new model of international cooperation based on mutual respect and participation between the two countries. Da Silva says it's the only such binational project of this size in the Americas.
É território regido por tratado.
From the moment you cross onto Itaipu land, you're not in Paraguay, nor are you in Brazil, he explains. It's a territory governed by a treaty and run by the Itaipu Binational Company. Itaipu has its own security force. Decisions are made by a governing board appointed in equal numbers by Paraguay and Brazil. The two countries have split everything down the middle: the construction, the energy production, the output, even the control room. A handful of employees sit around computers. Half are Brazilian, the other half are Paraguayan. In front of the room, one clock shows the time in Paraguay, the other the time in Brazil, 1 hour later.
Itaipu, ela não é brasileira nem paraguaia, ela é binacional.
It's Itaipu, says former Itaipu worker Lasso Cardoso. It's neither Brazilian nor Paraguayan. It's binational. And there's an important detail, right? He says, it can't be sold. But this type of joint relationship is not easy. Over the last year, Brazil and Paraguay held heated discussions over a new operating contract for Itaipu. The tension was over the price of energy produced. Carlos Enrique Santana is a political scientist at Brazil's Federal University of Integration in Foz do Iguaçu.
Qual é a questão que estava em jogo dentro do Paraguai? De lado,
he explains that Paraguay sells back to Brazil a substantial chunk of its portion of Itaipu energy. So the Paraguayan government wanted to sell back its excess energy to Brazil at a higher rate in order to use those resources for investments in other areas, he says, while the Brazilians believe the rate should stay lower according to the previous deal. They finally came to an agreement in May, settling closer to Paraguay's proposal, locking in a price per kilowatt hour just above market rate. Many, including Professor Santana, say it wasn't a good deal, but it was a deal. And that is the essence of this binational experiment. For The World, I'm Michael Fox, Foz do Iguaçu, Brazil.
The food crisis in Sudan is urgent and getting more so every day. The war there between two generals has laid waste to the country, destroying cities, infrastructure, and crops. Aid groups have been warning for months of imminent famine. And after a recent visit to Sudan, the head of the World Health Organization, Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, called on the world to, quote, wake up. Lainey Kinsley is a spokesperson for the UN's World Food Program in Sudan. We reached her today in Nairobi.
So Sudan right now is the world's largest and also worst hunger crisis, spanning the entire country, with half of the population, or one in two Sudanese, facing acute hunger. The areas that are most affected are, first of all, in North Darfur, where famine has been confirmed, and 13 other areas that are at risk of famine, largely in Darfur, Kordofan, and Khartoum and Jazeera, where there is active fighting ongoing.
And I know there are specific definitions for food insecure, for famine. You said there are famine conditions. What does that mean for the folks living through that?
They are not able to afford food. They have no regular access to food. So they are literally living day by day just to have some sustenance. What that looks like on ground, as I've myself seen it, especially from people who've just come from conflict hotspots like Khartoum, is that they're, you know, mixing malt juices out of flour or sorghum or any kind of cereal and really stretching the resources that they have, eating leaves off trees, eating grass. And so that is what famine-like or catastrophic conditions look like.
The head of the WHO, as I mentioned, Tedros Ghebreyesus, is also trying to sound the alarm here, it sounds like, calling on the world community to wake up. How does the need for aid in Sudan compare to what has been flowing from the international community?
So right now, overall, for the humanitarian response for all sectors, that's health, medical, food, shelter, water, the response is only 50% funded. And if we look at just food alone, if we were to support all 25.6 million people that are in need of assistance, that would cost billions of dollars.
So we've been talking about how much aid is flowing toward Sudan, but there are also, of course, obstacles of actually getting that aid to the people that need it in an active war zone. Can you describe some of the obstacles there for humanitarian workers?
Well, right now, our biggest obstacle is actually the rainy season. In Sudan, it's a very heavy rainy season, one of the worst rainy seasons in the last 40 years, which means that roads are flooded. There are seasonal riverbeds that are basically have turned into lakes, which makes it very difficult to get trucks of assistance and vital aid supplies to the areas that are most at need. There is damaged infrastructure. And that is exactly why we would need every single corridor to get humanitarian aid in open.
There were recent peace talks in Switzerland where the warring parties in Sudan didn't even talk to each other directly. Was there anything talked about at those talks that might lead to humanitarian corridors, or do any exist right now?
So what is WFP we've seen concretely on the ground since those talks is that one critical border from Chad into West Darfur, which is called the Adre border crossing, has now been open, and we are getting trucks of aid supplies in every single day through that border crossing. We've also been granted more access from Port Sudan in the east towards the entire Darfur region. And it is critical that any of these corridors remain open, and additional pressure building off of these talks from the U.S., from Saudi, from all actors involved is essential to humanitarian efforts on the ground.
I want to ask you now about the two groups that are at war here. The paramilitary rapid support forces is where I'll start. They've repeatedly been shown to have attacked civilians and committed serious atrocities. The Sudanese Armed Forces is the other party responsible for the ongoing war. Is that, of course, also preventing food from reaching civilians?
Absolutely. I mean, we've struggled with access interferences from both sides, both the RSF and the Sudanese Armed Forces. In these access interferences or impediments manifest themselves in very different ways. The Sudanese Armed Forces have put in, you know, bureaucratic clearances, basically lengthy paperwork that allow us to be able to move trucks full of vital nutrition and food supplies across the country. So though the impediments on the SAF side are much more bureaucratic and paperwork, as I mentioned, whereas on the RSF side, it's, you know, not lack of guarantees for security, threats against aid convoys. And but both warring parties are responsible at the end of the day that aid is not getting to people who absolutely need it and who have been bearing the brunt of this conflict now for close to 18 months.
Lainey Kinsley is a spokesperson for the UN's World Food Program in Sudan. And now let's catch you up on a few more headlines from around the globe.
Overnight, Ukrainian drones struck a large military depot in a town deep inside Russia. Ukraine says the attack in the Tver region destroyed military warehouses there. Ukraine, as we've been reporting, has been striking deeper inside Russia with increasing frequency.
U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders wants to stop more than $20 billion in U.S. arms sales to Israel. The long-shot effort is the most substantive pushback yet from Congress in response to Israel's actions in Gaza over the past year.
And in Australia, police took down a messaging app called Ghost that was used by a global criminal network. The founder was arrested in Sydney. Dozens of other suspects were caught in Canada, Sweden, Ireland, and Italy. Police said Ghost was invented for the purpose of aiding criminal activity.
Head to theworld.org to follow more of our reporting and subscribe to The World on your favorite podcast app.
Across the globe, elections are losing credibility. That is the conclusion of a new report by the International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance in Sweden. Despite a record number of elections happening worldwide this year, voter turnout has been on the decline and contested results have become more common. The World's TBS Zeya reports on a global trend of democracy under strain.
The world is almost evenly split between 91 democracies and 88 autocracies. But those authoritarian regimes currently host 70% of the world's population, or close to 6 billion people. That's according to Varieties of Democracy, a Swedish institute devoted to measuring democracy.
It clearly has not been the best period for democratization in the last 20 years.
Daniel Trisman is a political scientist at UCLA. He says even when extreme ideologies like fascism or communism have been discredited, and even in a world highly interconnected, authoritarians manage to survive, and some even thrive. Part of the reason, he says, is that modern dictators look very different from the tyrants of the 20th century, like Hitler or Stalin, who were responsible for the deaths of millions.
The new type of dictator pretends to be democratic. They hold elections, but quietly manipulate them to make sure that they win. They allow a certain degree of independent media, but they just make sure that its audience is never very large. And they project this image of popular, benevolent leaders.
There are still violent dictatorships in places like Syria, Egypt, or Saudi Arabia. But Truman says the strategy of pretending to be democratic seems to work better in the modern world, until it stops working. Once people start to push back and take to the streets, many of these regimes end up morphing into tyrannies.
And what we've seen in some cases recently in Russia, in Venezuela, in Turkey, is dictators who tried to use this more sophisticated model of reverting to a more heavy-handed model based on fear.
And once that happens, strongmen have no other option than clinging to power, he says, because there is no peaceful retirement plan for them. A number of brutal dictators who went into exile in the past were prosecuted abroad for crimes committed in office. That includes Augusto Pinochet from Chile or Slobodan Milosevic from Yugoslavia.
That showed to every other dictator around the world that they were not safe elsewhere, that they were only safe in their own country in power.
Moises Naim, the author of several books on autocratic power, says this created huge incentives for strongmen to retain power. So how do you topple a dictator who refuses to leave? Marcel Dirsus is a political scientist and the author of How Tyrants Fall.
To bring down a tyrant, what you need to do is to weaken the incumbent, strengthen the alternative elites, and empower the masses.
But in the most totalitarian regimes, any dissent is quickly repressed. And in those cases, the options to oust the dictator are very limited. Dictators like this tend to fall only when they make a public mistake or a miscalculation. Marcel Dirsus says it's important to prevent autocrats from taking power, especially at a time when they are gaining popularity. And even when liberal societies are less likely to tolerate an autocrat, no country is completely immune to them.
Tyranny is not just something that happens over there. You know, our freedoms are not God-given, and it is imperative that we prepare ourselves for a situation in which our own freedoms could come under threat.
Because once a leader becomes a tyrant, they can be extremely difficult to remove. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isaiah, Mexico City.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. In Japan, people are sounding the alarm about a rice shortage. They say reasonably priced, decent quality rice is getting hard to find in grocery stores. Blame has fallen on the weather and even tourists. But farmers think something else is going on. Hannah Kirshner brings us the story from Kaga, Japan.
Mako Sato is at least the fifth generation in her family to farm.
My house, if this machine is the same price.
She points to a combine and says it costs as much as her house. The red and white machine circles wide, golden fields, harvesting and threshing rice. Beyond the field, blue mountains fade into the sky. The largest peak, Mount Haku, is obscured by haze today.
The view is beautiful.
Every farmer says the view of Mount Haku is most beautiful from their fields. Everyone, Sato tells me. To us, Mount Haku is the most beautiful from here. Sato's farm spans 47 hectares, over 100 acres, scattered around the town of Kaga. I follow her across a big road to her warehouse. An employee on a forklift is loading one-ton bags of rice onto a semi-truck.
Those are just huge bags of rice.
Sato's rice will get mixed with rice from other farms and sold through a wholesaler, or JA, the national co-op that controls about half of all rice distribution in Japan. Sato's father is operating machines that dry and hull the rice, then separate out poor quality grains that are cracked or unripe. Last summer was really hot. Like a lot of farmers, Sato had a higher proportion of poor quality rice than usual. This year was hot too. We learned, and I think this year we did a good job of things like taking measures against insects and heat, and letting cold water into the paddies frequently, Sato says. All of our rice is first class this year. It looks good. Farmers are wondering, is there really a rice shortage? Really? She asks. Sato makes her contribution to the government's emergency stock of rice every year. And here in Kaga, there seems to be plenty of rice. At a local JA retail outlet, the bulk rice bins are full. But TV news programs have been showing images of empty supermarket shelves in places like Tokyo, and people waiting in line to buy this year's new crop of rice. I get on a call with someone I hope can explain the disconnect. Rice policy expert Kazuhito Yamashita.
I used to work for the Japanese Ministry of Agriculture, Forests and Fisheries.
He's now with the Cannon Institute for Global Studies. I ask him if he thinks people are stocking up because of recent warnings about a possible mega quake in eastern Japan.
Yeah, that is true to a certain extent. And yesterday, my wife bought some rice in the supermarket, so you know, to prepare for the worst.
But Yamashita says the rice shortage actually started months ago. Then are tourists to blame? The government has been focused on bringing back pre-pandemic levels of tourism. Now that the tourists are back, averaging 3 million a month, the Ministry of Agriculture, Forestry, and Fisheries claims they're eating a lot of rice. But Yamashita is skeptical.
3 million people do not stay in Japan in the entire month. They just stay in Japan 7 to 10 days.
And even if all those tourists eat rice 3 meals a day, he estimates only a 0.5% increase in rice consumption. Last year's extreme heat definitely impacted the rice harvest, but Yamashita says the real reason for the current rice shortage is government policy. A so-called set-aside program pays farmers not to use their land for growing rice. Many countries, including the U.S., use set-aside policies too, to reduce grain surpluses. The point is to keep prices stable. What's unusual, though, is how long Japan has kept this policy.
For more than 50 years. And that is a very stupid program.
The set-aside program is at odds with another government goal, to increase Japan's food self-sufficiency. Yamashita says Japan should end the set-aside program and subsidize farmers to produce rice instead of paying them not to. Takuma Hasegawa runs a mid-sized natural farm in another part of Kaga. There are subsidies to grow other crops, like soybeans or wheat in the paddies, not rice, Hasegawa says. I've followed him down a narrow gravel road to one of his rice fields. The ripening grains rustle in the breeze. Every few minutes, fighter jets from a nearby Air Force base pass overhead. Hasegawa gently inspects a panicle of rice. The grains have turned golden brown, but the stem is still green.
When half of it turns brown, it's ready to harvest.
As we stand in the field, Hasegawa explains that the majority of Japan's rice farmers don't farm full-time. They work another full-time job and grow rice on the side. These farmers are no longer making any profit, Hasegawa says. They're only farming for the sake of protecting their land and maintaining community in the countryside, not to make money. More and more of these part-time farmers are quitting or aging out of farming. Direct subsidies to farmers could make it more appealing for younger farmers like Hasegawa to start or expand a rice farm. But Hasegawa isn't waiting for that change. He's sidestepping the system. In his warehouse, a signboard is filled with a few dozen names of what he calls rice field owners. These customers make a 5 to 10 year commitment to pre-buy the harvest of an entire field. Since Hasegawa practices natural farming, he doesn't have to worry about the rising cost of commercial fertilizers and herbicides. His costs are fairly stable. It takes a lot of money to start a new farm or increase the area of your farm, to buy machines and hire people, Hasegawa says. With this system, the farmer has less risk because they don't have to worry about whether they can sell the rice. And his customers benefit from a direct connection to the farmer. The consumer can rest assured that a share of rice is coming to them, Hasegawa says. He tells me there are a lot of people worried about a food crisis in the next 5 to 10 years. Even now, as freshly harvested rice hits the shelves, consumers are buying it right away. That means by this time next year, there could be a similar shortage. For The World, I'm Hannah Kirshner, Kaga, Japan.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here tomorrow.